This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of Present Over Perfect, Leaving Behind Frantic for a Simpler, More Soulful Way of Living, by Shauna Nyquist, published by Zondervan, and read by the author.
Foreword by Brené Brown. A few months after I met Shauna for the first time at a speaking event, she emailed me to ask if we could get together during her upcoming trip to Houston. Having recently finished her book, Bread and Wine, I was totally inspired to buck my normal response of, I'd love to, but I'm crazy busy right now, in favor of a hearty, yes, come over and I'll cook dinner. Shauna has a Benedictine passion about hospitality, gatherings, and feeding friends that I find contagious and inspiring. Of course, once the day arrived, my inspiration morphed into dread. My house was a disaster, I was 2 weeks late on a writing deadline, and I looked as tired and burnt out as I felt. What really sounded good was an evening of numbing out in front of the television with chips and queso, alone. In the middle of my should I cancel or not dance, I remembered this quote from Saint Benedict, "Let all guests who arrive be received like Christ." Would I cancel on Jesus to hide out from my life with snack food and Law and Order reruns? Honestly, I hope not. But there are days when I'm not so sure. And don't worry, God is totally clear about this struggle. We discuss it on a regular basis. On this particular day, I decided to welcome Shauna in the most holy way I knew, with love and total honesty. I heated up some turkey chili and tamales, threw on some comfy pants, and opened the door. We hugged for a minute, and then she looked me straight in the eye and asked, "How are you?" I could tell she really wanted to know. I got teary-eyed, and I said, "I'm tired, confused, a little lonely, but holding on." Shauna smiled as her eyes welled up. "Me too, pal. Me too. It's so hard sometimes." Our time together that night was sacred for a simple reason. We chose to be present over pretending to be perfect. I believe the most powerful way to share what it really means to show up and be present is through story. And that's Shauna's offering with this book. Her gift to us is a collection of stories that are real, honest, and familiar in a way that's both comforting and a little uncomfortable, like the truth can be. Present Over Perfect is an open-armed invitation to welcome the people we love and even ourselves back into our lives. It's not an easy call, but Shauna's at the door, and she knows exactly how to make us feel at home. God hasn't invited us into a disorderly, unkempt life, but into something holy and beautiful, as beautiful on the inside as the outside. 1 Thessalonians 4:7, The Message. Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. And I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese high in the clean blue air are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. Ship to Wreck. And ah, my love, remind me. What was it that I said? I can't help but pull the earth around me to make my bed. And ah, my love, remind me, what was it that I did? Did I drink too much? Am I losing touch? Did I build this ship to wreck? Florence and the Machine. This is a love story, like all my favorite stories. It's a story about letting yourself be loved in all your imperfect, scarred, non-spectacular glory, and it's about the single most profound life change I've yet encountered. One Saturday, 3 years ago, I stared at the ceiling of a hotel room in Dallas, exhausted. I said to myself, if anyone else wants to live this life I've created for myself, they're more than welcome to try, but I'm done. I need a new way to live. I was 36 years old. Aaron and I had been married for 11 years, and we had 2 boys, a 1-year-old and a 6-year-old. I was finishing a book, a month from submitting a manuscript, longer than the previous ones I'd written, and with recipes this time, which meant that during the weekdays I was writing essays, and in the evenings I tested recipes over and over, flinging pans of burned brownies into the sink and starting again, butterflying pork tenderloin, taking notes on paper spattered with vinegar, dusted with spices. On the weekends, often I was traveling, speaking at conferences, retreats, and churches. In many ways, I loved this life, loved my husband, adored my kids, was so thankful to be a writer. But it's like I was pulling a little red wagon, and as I pulled it along, I filled it so full that I could hardly keep pulling. That red wagon was my life, and the weight of pulling it was destroying me. I was aware that I was missing the very things I so badly longed for: connection, meaning, peace. But there was something that kept driving me forward, a set of beliefs and instincts that kept me pushing, 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 even as I was longing to rest. My health was suffering. I was frequently sick. I slept poorly and not enough. I got migraines and then vertigo. The muscles in my neck and shoulders felt more like rock than tissue, and the circles under my eyes looked like bruises. My heart, the heart I used to offer so freely, the heart I used to wear proudly on my sleeve, had retreated deep inside my chest, wounded and seeking protection. My ability to taste and connect and feel deeply had been badly compromised. My faith was stilted. It had become, over time, yet another way to try and fail, rather than a respite or healing relationship. I loved my life, but I had become someone I didn't want to be around. I'd become someone I didn't want to be. This book is an account of my winding, messy journey from exhaustion to peace, from isolation to connection, from hustling and multitasking to sacred presence. And this book is an invitation, too, a hand reaching out across the pages, inviting you into that same journey, because it has been the greatest, most challenging, most rewarding sea change of my adult life. Not long after that Saturday afternoon realization, a mentor of mine invited me to an event with her in San Francisco, where she lives. I wanted to go. I didn't want to go. I didn't want to be away from my kids. I couldn't decide anymore what to do and what not to do. So I left her email in my inbox for a while and then sent back a rambling, incoherent message about how my life felt so different than I thought it would, how I couldn't tell which end was up and couldn't put the brakes on, no matter how many times I tried. She emailed back immediately. The line that stuck out to me was this: stop right now. Remake your life from the inside out. For almost 2 decades, this wise woman's words have had a prophetic connection to my life. God has used her words in the right moments and seasons in such profound ways, and these latest words perhaps more than any others. In that moment, I had no idea what it meant to remake my life from the inside out. Now, more than 3 years later, I'm so deeply thankful to look back and realize that's just what I've done, although in the twistiest, most circuitous possible way. I tried all the outside ways first. I imagined the changes I needed to make were about time management, or perhaps having the cleaners come more often. I quickly found it was not about managing time or housekeeping. It was not about to-do lists or scheduling or minutes and hours. This journey has been about love, about worth, about God, about what it means to know Him and be loved by Him in a way that grounds and reorders everything. I've been remaking my life from the inside out, and I want to invite you into that creative, challenging, life-altering work. It is work, of course. It feels, I'd imagine, like adding a basement to a house that's already been standing for decades. I thought it would be more like adding new shutters, but I'm finding it to be more like lifting up a home and starting to dig, reorienting the very foundation. There's nothing superficial about this process. Over the course of these last years, I've been to a counselor and a spiritual director and many doctors. I've prayed and fasted. I've read countless books. I've been on a silent retreat at a Jesuit retreat center and another at a summer camp on Lake Geneva. I've failed miserably and begun again, asked for help, asked for grace, asked for prayer. And beyond those things I've done, the more life-altering parts of the work are those things I've not done, the moments I've allowed or forced myself to stop, to rest, to breathe, to connect. That's where life is, I'm finding. That's where grace is. That's where delight is. I'm not by any means at the end of this journey, but I have traveled this beautiful new road far enough to know that this is how I want to live the rest of my days. I'm almost 40, feeling midlife-y like crazy, and this is how I want to live the second half of my life. Richard Rohr says the skills that take you through the first half of your life are entirely unhelpful for the second half. To press the point a little bit, those skills I developed that supposedly served me well for the first half, as I inspect them a little more closely, didn't actually serve me at all. They made me responsible and capable and really, really tired. They made me productive and practical, and inch by inch, year by year, they moved me further and further from the warm, whimsical person I used to be, and I missed her. The two sins at play here, I believe, are gluttony and pride, the desire to escape and the desire to prove, respectively. I want to taste and experience absolutely everything, and I want to be perceived as wildly competent. The opposite of gluttony is sobriety in the widest sense, which is not my strong suit. And the opposite of pride, one might say, is vulnerability, essentially saying, this is who I am. Not the sparkly image, not the smoke and mirrors, not the accomplishments or achievements. This is me, with all my limitations, with all my weaknesses. It's as though God, in his graciousness and wisdom, pressed his thumbs into the twin wounds of my life, the desire to prove and the desire to escape. And in that pressing is the invitation. What I'm learning essentially is to stand where I am, plain and sometimes tired, unflashy, profoundly unspectacular, but present and connected and grounded deeply in the love of God, which is changing everything. My prayer is that this book will be 1,000 invitations springing up from every page, calling you to leave behind the heavy weight of comparison, competition, and exhaustion, and to recraft a life marked by meaning, connection, and unconditional love. Part 1. Sea Change. Full fathom 5 thy father lies. Of his bones are coral made. Those are pearls that were his eyes. Nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Sea nymphs hourly ring his bell, ding dong. Hark, now I hear them, ding dong bell. Shakespeare, The Tempest. Sea change. Here I am on the porch, and that feels fitting. Outside as opposed to in, watching the water and the trees, listening to the music of the waves and the wind. The word sea change is from Shakespeare, from The Tempest. A man is thrown into the sea, and under the water, he is transformed from what he was into something entirely new, something rich and strange. The beautiful and obvious connection, of course, baptism. We are tipped backward into the water and raised into new life. We leave behind the old, the sin, the regret, the failings, and we rise out of the water cleansed, made new, a sea change, if there ever was one. This is the story of my sea change, the journey from one way of living to another. It's also an invitation to a sea change of your own. No matter your age, your gender, your season of life, no matter your politics or profession, your sexuality or your faith tradition, you are invited into a sea change. I'm coming to believe that there are a handful of passages in our lives that transform us, not unlike conversions, where the old is gone and the new is come. For me, this has taken the shape of a nearly 4-year journey from exhaustion, multitasking, frantic and frayed living, into peace, connection, and rest. When I look back on my life, I can see a couple other sea change seasons. One was my senior year of college, when I left behind chaos and disconnection for a renewed connection to God, to his people, to his word, and his ways of living. Another was when I was 29 and was fired from a job I held far too dearly. Also, I was pregnant, and I was sitting on a book contract I was terrified to complete. That season was like off-roading a little bit, like being plunged into new ways of living. Writing, mothering, all the while grasping back to a job and identity that was no longer mine to grasp. Years ago, a wise friend told me that no one ever changes until the pain level gets high enough. That seems entirely true. The inciting incident for life change is almost always heartbreak. Something becomes broken beyond repair, too heavy to carry. In the words of the recovery movement, unmanageable. In each of my three sea changes, the life I'd created had broken to pieces in my hands. When I was 21, my life was marked by drinking and dating and books, and only one of those things was helpful. When I was 29, my attachment to my job was such a white-knuckled thing, and I believed that getting fired was essentially God's grace, prying my little fingers off that identity, digit by digit. And in this current sea change, my disconnectedness from my soul and from the people I care most about has become so painful that I'm willing to remake the whole of my life. I've always been the bearer of what my husband calls a Catholic imagination, as opposed to a Protestant one. I don't know where that came from, except that growing up in Chicago means growing up on all sides happily surrounded by Irish and Italian and Polish Catholics. We were the odd ones out, certainly, in our church that met in a movie theater without crosses or priests. More than that, though, I think this particularly Catholic imagination was born in me because my earliest loves, and my greatest loves to this day, were stories, meals, and water. Another way to look at it, the liturgy, communion, baptism. I'm not at all an in-my-head person. I'm a blood and guts and body person, a dirt and berries and trees person. I'm a smell and taste and feel and grasp between my fingers person. And both life around the table and life on the water are ways of living that I experience through the tactile sensations of them, not the ideas that float above them. This sea change in me began, fittingly, at the lake. I've spent summers all my life in this little lakeshore town. My grandparents had a cottage here, and both grandfathers had sailboats in this marina. My parents' first date was a walk on this pier. This town and this stretch of Lake Michigan is in my blood, deep in my bones. For the last several years, each July, Aaron and the boys and I rent a house we love, a blue house with a wide porch and bright pink hydrangeas. We walk to the beach and the pier and the ice cream shop. We take the boat out every day, sometimes twice. We buy most of our produce at the farmer's market, and we pick blueberries and cherries to freeze and eat all year long. It's a 3-hour drive to this small Michigan town from our house outside Chicago, but they feel worlds apart. I can feel myself exhale as we exit the highway and turn onto Phoenix Street, and the first glimpse of the water makes my heart leap every single time. And so, as is our custom, we arrived at the lake that July, breathless from travel, sleepless from kids, wrung out from a writing project that still wasn't finished. Looking back, it's easy to see now that I was at my worst. Weepy, snapping at everyone and everything, anxiety sky high, deep connection to myself, to God, to the people I love most, at an all-time deficit. That July began the invitation to a new way of living. And each subsequent July has been a reset, a recalibration, a deeper invitation. It's July once again, and I would never tell you that I'm finished with this journey, all fixed up, nailing it. But I will tell you, with great gratitude and joy, that I'm fundamentally changed, rebuilt from the inside. I've left behind some ways of living that I once believed were necessary and right, that I now know were toxic and damaging. Among them, pushing, proving, overworking, ignoring my body and my spirit, trusting my ability to hustle more than God's ability to heal. My life is marked now by quiet, connection, simplicity. It's taken every bit of more than 3 years to learn these things, and like any good hard work, I fail and try again more often than I'd prefer. But there's a peace that defines my days, a settledness, a groundedness. I've been searching for this in a million places all outside myself, and it astounds me to realize that the groundedness is within me. And that maybe it was there all along. I've always trusted things outside myself, believing that my own voice couldn't be trusted, that my own preferences and desires would lead me astray, that it was far wiser and safer to listen to other people, other voices, the voices of the crowd. I believed it was better to measure my life by metrics out there, instead of values deeply held in my own soul and spirit. And in the same way, I've always given my best energy to things outside myself, believing that I'd be fine, that I was a workhorse, that I didn't need special treatment or babying or, heaven help me, self-care. Self-care was for the fragile, the special, the dainty. I was a linebacker, a utility player, a worker bee. I ate on the run, slept in my clothes, worshiped at the altar of my to-do list, ignored the crying out of my body and soul like they were nothing more than the buzz of pesky mosquitoes. Now I know that in the same way I've always believed God's Spirit dwells deeply in this world, it also dwells deeply in me. I've known that cognitively, but my life spoke otherwise. Now I know that the best thing I can offer to this world is not my force or energy, but a well-tended spirit, a wise and brave soul. My regrets. How many years I bruised people with my fragmented, anxious presence. How many moments of connection I missed, too busy, too tired, too frantic, and strung out on the drug of efficiency. Now I know there's another way. You don't have to damage your body and your soul and the people you love most in order to get done what you think you have to get done. You don't have to live like this. Stuffed. Something reached fever pitch in my life, and then something snapped, died, and no amount of coaxing will bring that thing back to life again. Something, it seems, is over. Maybe these things go in cycles. Someone told me recently that we experience a fundamental change every 7 years. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's about having a new baby, one that we struggled for, one that arrived after a long and difficult pregnancy, one that will most likely be our last child, the baby of our little family. Maybe it's about biting off more than I can chew professionally, more books, more deadlines, more traveling and speaking. Maybe it's God calling a big cosmic timeout on me, giving me a chance at a new way of living. This is what I know. I've always been a more is more person, and something shifted in me this summer. Something inside me said, no more. No more pushing and rushing. No more cold pizza at midnight. No more flights. No more books. No more house guests. No more all of these things, even things I love, things I long for, things that make me happy. No more. Only less. Less of everything. Less stress, less crying, less noise, less TV, less wine, less online shopping, less one more thing, one more thing, one more thing. Whether that one more thing is a trip or a movie or a boat ride or a play date, less cramming 36 or 56 or 106 hours into a day that has only ever held 24. One night with friends, we were talking about the future, about how to see what's next, how to know what change your life is leading you toward. One friend said that a way to get at your desire or dream is to answer this question. If someone gave you a completely blank calendar and a bank account as full as you wanted, what would you do? The first thing that leapt into my mind, stop. I would stop. I would rest. I would do nothing at all. I would sleep. The thought of it almost made me weep. The important thing is not how much I did this year, how many trips I took for fun or for work, or how much the baby did or didn't sleep, although didn't is the operative word. I want to tell you all those things. I want to make a case for why I'm so tired. I want to run you through the list, partially because I want you to feel it, to feel as tired and glazed and undone as I feel, but also because I don't want you to think I'm weak. Not just any little thing could make me this tired. Not just a baby or something, not just a book. I'm not one of those normal people who just gets tired sometimes. I'm so strong and full of energy. I'm so extra capable and phenomenally tough. I've been so committed to prove, as though anyone cares, that I can handle it all. And I've handled a whole lot of things. I've had babies and lost babies and written books and spoken at events and run races and hosted all manner of showers and dinners and parties. I've done so many things. And I'm so tired. I miss my friends. I sleep terribly. I snap at my kids more than I want to. And then I lay in bed at night feeling guilty about it. I spend more time asking my husband for help with the dishes or the kids than I do asking him about his life and dreams and ideas. Who wins then? I handled it all. I showed them. But who's them? Who cares? Whose voice am I listening to? What am I trying to prove? What would happen? What would be lost if I stopped? Or if I slowed down to a pace that felt less like a high-speed chase all day, every day? What if I trusted that there would be more time down the road? That if that book has to be read, or that party has to be thrown, or that race has to be run, or that trip has to be taken, there will be time to take it, do it, read it, write it later. Later. I don't operate in later. I've always been proud of that. But look where it's gotten me. Stuffed, exhausted, wrung out, and overscheduled to the point where even the things I love to do sound like obligations. And my deepest desires and fantasies involve sleep and being left alone. My greatest dream is to be left alone. Things have gone terribly awry. There has to be another way, and I'm going to find it. I'm going to make the space to taste my life once again. I'm going to find a new way of living that allows for rest, as much rest as I need, not just enough to get me through without tears, but enough to feel alive and whole, grounded and gracious, things I haven't been in years. What I ache for these days is space, silence, stillness, Sabbath. I want to clear away space and noise and things to do and things to manage. I want less of everything. Less stuff, less rushing, less proving and pushing, less hustle, less snapping at my kids so they'll get themselves into the car faster so we can go buy more stuff that we're going to throw away, less consumption, less feeling like my mind is fragmented and my stomach is bloated and my life is out of control. I feel like I'm driving a car 100 miles an hour with music blaring out of open windows. I screech into a parking lot. Throw the car in park, sprint into 7-Eleven, and race to the back of the store. I throw my head back under the Slurpee machine, and I fill my mouth with red Slurpee, tons and tons, running down my face and neck. I just keep gulping and gulping, sticky red corn syrupy sludge more and more, and then I stand up, smeared and dripping, and race back for the car. On to the next thing, jamming the car into reverse, music at mind-numbing volume. That's how I feel. And what I want is one strawberry in total silence. No 100 miles an hour, no music, no fake red mess all over my face and neck. I want one real strawberry. And I don't know how to get there from here. I'm stuffed. You can use whatever term you want, besetting sin, shadow side, strength and weakness, the very thing that makes you you, that makes you great, that makes you different from everyone else, is also that thing that, unchecked, will ruin you. For me, it's lust for life. It's energy, curiosity, hunger. I'll come back around this block 1,000 times in my lifetime, probably. I hope I'm getting better at it. Hope that I'm writing the imbalance more incrementally these days than I was 10 years ago. For the most part, I have been, I think. But then the wheels fell off again, and I realized this time around it's more than a tune-up, more than writing a pesky small imbalance. This time around, it's about an overhaul, about digging around the foundations and the assumptions and building a new way of living from the ground up, because I'm stuffed. Running laps. I never know I need quiet and stillness until it's too late, so the lack of stillness scrapes me raw. Henry was sick this weekend, and then just as soon as he was on the upswing, Aaron got sick. And then Monday morning, when I so desperately needed everyone to be better, all three woke up sick. A boogery little boy, a big boy with a big barking cough, Aaron chilled and feverish. And I was furious. Furious at whom, I don't know, because you can't help being sick. But what I felt was trapped and angry. I didn't want to wipe another nose, fold another little set of pajamas, measure out another dose of Tylenol. I wanted to leave. Three sick boys dependent on me feels a little too much like the rest of my life. I've spent a lifetime establishing my role as responsible party. What that means is that I take care of it. And by it, I mean everything. I troubleshoot, multitask, strategize, especially in seasons when I travel a lot. When I'm home, I'm in the zone. New pants for Henry, diapers for Mac, permission slips and orthodontist appointments. If I'm honest, I overcompensate for my absences by trying to make my home time spectacular. Look, I didn't miss a beat. Look, you've got everything you need and then some. Look, you didn't even notice I was gone. What with all the perfectly folded clothes and perfectly washed grapes and perfectly planned activities. I hate being gone, so I make sure that when I'm home, I'm super home. Lots of homemade meals and clean closets. As emphatically home as possible. And so on that first morning that Henry was sick, I was cleaning up from the party we'd had the night before, 10 adults and 10 kids. I was unpacking our bags from our trip to South Haven the day before that. I was laundering new bedding for Henry's room and stuffing a duvet into its new case, puttering around, putting things away. This is what I call fake resting. I'm wearing pajamas. The kids are watching cartoons, snuggling under blankets, eating waffles. Erin's reading or sleeping. It looks like I'm resting too, but I'm not. I'm ticking down an endless list, sometimes written, always mental, getting things back into their right spots, changing the laundry, wiping down the countertops. Some might say this is being a mother or a homemaker, or this is what women have been doing for generations, tending to the home stuff while men and children go about their leisure. Maybe so. But this woman and mom is exhausted and tired of being exhausted. So I fake rested on Saturday and then again on Sunday. The kids and Erin napped. They played with Legos and went to bed early. They watched movies and ate leftover pumpkin pie. And I caught up on emails and ordered Christmas presents and cleaned out a closet and started packing for an upcoming trip. I fake rested instead of real rested. And then I found that I was real tired. It feels ludicrous to be a grown woman, a mother, and still learning how to rest. But here I am, baby stepping to learn something kids know intuitively. Part of being an adult is taking responsibility for resting your body and your soul. And part of being an adult is learning to meet your own needs. Because when it comes down to it, with a few exceptions, no one else is going to do it for you. Frankly, the men I know don't generally struggle with this. They've been raised to eat when they're hungry, sleep when they're tired, run when they're antsy, leave when they're ready to leave. But even the most driven, articulate, strong women I know struggle to really meet their own needs. A friend and I recently talked about how deeply invested we both are in people thinking that we're low maintenance. We both want to be seen as flexible, tough, roll with anything kinds of women. And this keeps us from asking for what we need for the fear of being labeled difficult or diva-ish. But what good is it going to do me to have people think I'm laid back and flexible when really that cherished reputation keeps me tangled up, needs unmet, voice silenced? I knew that I needed to work less. That's absolutely true. That's the first step. But it's trickier than that. The internal voice that tells me to hustle can find a to-do list in my living room as easily as it can in an office. It's not about paid employment. It's about trusting that the hustle will never make you feel the way you want to feel. In that way, it's a drug, and I fall for the initial rush every time. If I push enough, I will feel whole. I will feel proud. I will feel happy. What I feel, though, is exhausted and resentful, but with well-organized closets. Who told me that keeping everything organized would deliver happiness? What a weird prescription for happiness. Why do I think that managing our possessions is a meaningful way of spending my time? Why do I think clean countertops means anything at all? Well, certainly my Dutch roots might have something to do with it, and my Midwestern upbringing. And I know that activity, any activity, keeps me from feeling. So that becomes a drug too. I'll run circles around this house, folding clothes and closing cabinets, sweeping and tending to things, never allowing myself to feel the cavernous ache. Which brings us literally to the heart of the conversation, the heart, the cavernous ache. Am I loved? Does someone see me? Do I matter? Am I safe? For most of my life, I've answered these questions with theological abstractions and then filled up any remaining uncertainty with noise and motion and experiences. In my teens and early 20s, this was mostly road trips and closing down bars and kissing and all manner of adventures. And then somewhere along the way, that frantic energy translated itself into work, that same manic devotion to keeping things moving, but this time not on the dance floor. I learned a long time ago that if I hustle fast enough, the emptiness will never catch up with me. First, I outran it by traveling and dancing and drinking 2-for-1 whiskey sours at Calypso on State Street in Santa Barbara. Then I outran it by lining up writing deadlines like train tracks and clicking over them one by one. Then I outran it by running laps around my living room, picking up toys and folding blankets as recently as yesterday. You can make a drug, a way to anesthetize yourself, out of anything. Working out, binge watching TV, working, having sex, shopping, volunteering, cleaning, dieting, any of those things can keep you from feeling pain for a while. That's what drugs do. And used like a drug over time, shopping or TV or work or whatever will make you less and less able to connect to the things that matter, like your own heart and the people you love. That's another thing drugs do. They isolate you. Most of us have a handful of these drugs, and it's terrifying to think of living without them. It is terrifying, wildly unprotected, vulnerable, staring our wounds right in the face. But this is where we grow, where we learn, where our lives actually begin to change. Dethroning the idol. Busyness is an illness of the spirit. Eugene Peterson. I come from a long line of hard workers, sheet metal workers, farmers, people for whom work is an estimable thing, something to respect and be grateful for. I got my first summer job when I was 11. I rode my bike 2 miles to the windsurfer shop down by the marina in South Haven. And while the owners and his friends, all in their 20s, slept off hangovers and ran to the beach at a moment's notice if the wind piped up, I decorated the shop's window displays and rearranged the stickers and sunglasses. And I went to one of those high schools where much was expected of us. AP classes and academic scholarships to good colleges. High test scores. Loads of extracurriculars rounding out our applications. While I was in high school, I was also volunteering several days a week and a few nights at my church, too. Devoted to the high school ministry, teaching Sunday school to the grade school kids. And I worked at the Gap and at Bologna's, a much-loved deli near my high school. In college, I was all over the map spiritually. Couldn't be bothered to attend chapel or church, but I took a full class load every semester, worked in the library, and worked at a summer camp that kept me running from morning till night, quite literally. All that to say, I've been working all my life. Work has been a through line, one that I'm very thankful for, one that has taught me so much about the benefits of structure, discipline, skill, communication, and responsibility. But at some point, good, clean work became something else. An impossible standard to meet, a frantic way of living, a practice of ignoring my body and my spirit in order to prove myself as the hardest of hard workers. As I unravel the many things that brought me to this crisis point, one is undeniably my own belief that hard work can solve anything, that pushing through is always the right thing, that rest and slowness are for weak people, not for high-capacity people like me. Oh, the things I did to my body and my spirit in order to maintain my reputation as a high-capacity person. Oh, the moments I missed with people I love because I was so very committed to being known as the strongest of the strong. Oh, the quiet moments alone with God I sacrificed in order to cross a few things off the to-do list I worshipped. Productivity became my idol, the thing I loved and valued above all else. We all have these complicated tangles of belief and identity and narrative. And one of the earliest stories I told about myself is that my ability to get it done is what kept me around. I wasn't beautiful. I didn't have a special or delicate skill, but I could get stuff done. And it seemed to me that ability was my entrance into the rooms into which I wanted to be invited. I couldn't imagine a world of unconditional love or grace where people simply enter into rooms because the door is open to anyone. The world that made sense to me was a world of earning and proving. And I was gutting it out just like everyone around me, frantically trying to prove my worth. Over time, a couple things happened. I wish I could tell you that when my health suffered, I paid attention, listened to my body, changed course. I did not. I kept going when I was sick, when I was pregnant, when I was still bleeding from a miscarriage. I kept going when I had vertigo, seasick on dry land, when I couldn't sleep past 3 a.m., when I threw up a couple times a week in stressful situations. But what I eventually realized is that the return on investment was not what I'd imagined, and that the expectations were only greater and greater. When you devote yourself to being known as the most responsible person anyone knows, more and more people call on you to be that highly responsible person. That's how it works. So the armload of things I was carrying became higher and higher, heavier and heavier, more and more precarious. At the same time, I was more and more aware that I was miserable. Not all the time, of course, but sometimes. In those rare moments when I let myself really feel honestly, instead of filling in the right answers, I realized with great surprise that this way of living was not making me happy at all. People called me tough and capable, and they said I was someone they could count on. Those are nice things, kind of, but they're not the same as loving or kind or joyful. I was not those things. I believed that work would save me, make me happy, solve my problems, that if I absolutely wore myself out, happiness would be waiting for me on the other side of all that work. But it wasn't. On the other side was just more work, more expectations, more responsibility. I trained a whole group of people to know that I would never say no. I would never say this is too much. I would never ask for more time or more space. I would never bow out. So they kept asking. And I was everyone's responsible girl. And I was so depleted, I couldn't even remember what whole felt like. I felt used up by the work. But of course, it was I who was using the work, not the other way around. I was using it to avoid something, to evade something. I was using it to prevent myself from becoming acquainted with the self who sat hidden by all the accomplishment. I wanted to get to know that person, make friends with her. I wanted to learn to beckon her out from behind the accomplishment, and when the wind piped up, take her off to the sea. You put up the chairs. I hope you live a life you're proud of. If you find that you are not, I hope you have the strength to start all over again. F. Scott Fitzgerald. I was at a pool party with some of my oldest, most favorite friends. I've known them since high school, so at this point they feel more like sisters. Anyone who knew you as an adolescent and still wants to spend time with you is a true friend. And really, their opportunity to blackmail you with stories of who you kissed and photos of you in overalls is enough reason to keep them around. We don't see each other nearly often enough, but when we do, we fall right back into familiar rhythm, like a song we've been singing all our lives. While we watched our kids jump off the diving board and dive for rings, while Jenny's husband grilled chicken and we drank lemonade icy from the cooler, we had the same conversation we always have when we see each other. We should get together more. It's just so busy. Everyone's so busy. Kids, you know, school, right? Work is insane. Piano and hockey. In-laws and baby showers and moving houses and book club, and who has time? And then someone buttoned up that conversation the same way we always do. But what are you going to do? We murmured agreement, sipped our lemonade, dangled our legs in the cool water, reminded our kids not to run near the pool. And on the way home, I couldn't help but think about that conversation, and in particular, that phrase. But what are you going to do? There we were, women in our 30s, educated, married, mothers, women who have careers, who manage homes and oversee companies. And there we were, utterly resigned to lives that feel overly busy and pressurized, disconnected and exhausted. But that's shifting the blame, right? Who's the boss, if not us? Who's forcing us to live this way? Or possibly do we not want to face the answer to that question, preferring to believe that we can't possibly be held responsible for what we've done? Years ago, Aaron and I were talking with the pastor of a fast-growing church and another friend, a more seasoned pastor. The first pastor was telling the story of how the church had exploded, how they couldn't stop the growth, how it was utterly out of their control, an inexplicable, unstoppable phenomenon. The seasoned pastor pushed him gently. You've built this, and it's okay to say that. You've intentionally and strategically built a very large church. It's okay to say that. The young pastor kept protesting, preferring the narrative of wild and unexplained growth. We had nothing to do with it, he insisted. Well, not nothing, said the older pastor. You kept putting up more chairs. And then our minds sort of exploded because it didn't occur to us that there was another option. We were all raised to build, build, build. Bigger is better, more is better, faster is better. It had never occurred to us in church building or any other part of life that someone would intentionally keep something small or deliberately do something slow. This conversation happened more than a decade ago. before slow food and artisanal everything, before a cultural return to handmade and homemade, toward limited editions and small batch cooking. And even though small batch cooking is now all the rage, for those of us who came of age in the more is more mentality, it can be hard to grasp the idea that we have some say over the size of our lives, that we have the agency and authority and freedom to make them smaller or larger, heavier or lighter. We were playing Legos a few weeks ago, and Aaron and I asked Henry about what he wants for our family in the next year. More adventures? More trips? Does he want to play soccer again? Does he want to start piano or move to a different town or get bunk beds? More this, he said. More time all together like this and at home. I like it when we're all together at home. Aaron and I looked at one another over his head, letting the other know that we heard it too, that we were paying attention. Aaron and I are both passionate, intense people. We're artists and makers, and neither of us ever saw ourselves in a leave work at the office 9-to-5 kind of arrangement. When we were single, we worked around the clock and loved it. And when we were married without kids, we did the same. We worked together, yelling across the hall from one office to the other about where we should stop for dinner on the way home, often after 10 p.m. But now those patterns are being upended for our two wild and silly darlings, and although we're making the changes for them, I can see how the changes benefit our neighbors and extended families and church community, and I can see very clearly how these changes benefit our marriage. Loving one's work is a gift, and loving one's work makes it really easy to neglect other parts of life. Aaron and I are talking a lot these days about work and time and calling, hoping to hold each one of them in their appropriate place, hoping to be honest about which ones matter more than the others. Being good at something feels great. Playing Ninja Turtles with two little boys for hours on end is sometimes less great. It's so easy to hop on a plane or say yes to one more meeting or project, to get that little buzz of being good at something, or the pleasure bump of making someone happy, whatever it is that drives you. And many of us continue to pretend that we don't have a choice. The success just happened, and we're along for the ride. The opportunities kept coming, and anyone in our position would have jumped to meet them. But we're the ones who keep putting up the chairs. If I work in such a way that I don't have enough energy to give to my marriage, I need to take down some chairs. If I say yes to so many work things that my kids only get to see tired mommy, I need to take down some chairs. I know I've let my work win sometimes. I know I've gotten the math wrong, sometimes unwittingly, believing I could fit in more than I could. There have been times I've hidden behind my work because work is easier to control than a hard conversation with someone you love. That's part of the challenge of stewarding a calling for all of us. You get it wrong sometimes, and part of stewarding that calling is sometimes taking down some chairs. We have more authority and therefore more responsibility than we think. We decide where the time goes. There's so much freedom in that and so much responsibility. That old question, but what are you going to do? I'm going to take down some chairs. The word that changed everything. The word that changed everything, of course, is no. I'd been saying yes and yes and yes, indiscriminately, haphazardly, resentfully for years. And I realized all at once that I'd spent all my yeses. And in order to find peace and health in my life, I needed to learn to say no. People love it when you say yes, and they get used to it. They start to figure out who the people are who will always say yes, always come through, always make it happen. If you're one of these people, it does cause a little freak out when you begin saying no. People are not generally down with this right away. That's okay. You may know that yes is an important word for me. Maybe you've seen my yes sweatshirt, my yes earrings, my yes tote bag, my yes tattoo. I'm not kidding about any of those things. Yes matters to me on a deep level. Saying a broad and brave yes to this beautiful world, to love and challenge and hard laughter and dancing and trying and failing, yes is totally my jam. But you can't have yes without no. Another way to say it, if you're not careful with your yeses, you start to say no to some very important things without even realizing it. In my rampant yes, yes, yesing, I said no without intending to rest, to peace, to groundedness, to listening, to deep and slow connection built over years instead of moments. All my yeses brought me to a shallow way of living, an exhausting, frantic lifestyle that actually ended up having little resemblance to that deep, brave yes I was searching for. And so if you, like me, have said too many yeses and found that all that hopeful, exciting, wide-open intention has actually left you scraped raw and empty, the word that can change everything is no. I know. I don't like it either. Yes is fun and sparkly and printed on tote bags. No? What if you saw someone wearing a sweatshirt that just said no? I do not want to sit next to that bundle of fun. But no became the scalpel I wielded as I remade my life, slicing through the tender tissue of what needed to go and what I wanted to remain. My mentor's words rang in my ears. Stop. Right now. Remake your life from the inside out. I don't know a way to remake anything without first taking down the existing structures, and that's what no does. It puts the brakes on your screaming fast life and gives you a chance to stop and inspect just exactly what you've created for yourself, as difficult as that might be. It was very difficult for me to learn to say no. I did it badly, awkwardly, sometimes too forcefully, and sometimes with so many disclaimers and weird ancillary statements that people actually had no idea what I was saying. I hovered endlessly after I said it. Was that okay? Are we okay? Because I love you. You know I love you, right? We're okay? But like anything you learn, it gets easier over time. You begin to build up muscle memory for what it feels like to say exactly what you feel, what you need, what your limitations are. And a very interesting thing begins to happen. Some people peer into your face with fascination. I want some of that, essentially, is what they're saying. Your honesty and freedom is giving them permission to be honest and free as well. And some people are not down with this way of living at all. They'd prefer you to continue over-functioning for their own purposes. Thank you very much. Or they're so wrapped up in their own hyper-functioning life that it's a personal affront to their value system when you say something insane like, I'm sorry, I can't do that. Bless them, but don't spend too much time with them. Draw close to people who honor your no, who cheer you on for telling the truth, who value your growth more than they value their own needs getting met or their own pathologies celebrated. Our little cooking club, my day-to-day lifeline best people, we're cheering each other on along this journey, and it makes all the difference. We talk every day, usually many times a day, and our constant refrain sounds like this. What can you lay down? How can we make this simpler? Are you getting enough rest? Can I take your kids for a couple hours? Instead of competing for who's busier or who's more tired, who's keeping more balls in the air, we're constantly looking for ways to help each other's lives get lighter, easier to carry, closer to the heart of what we love, less clogged with expectations and unnecessary tasks. These women are like my training wheels as I learn this, keeping me upright as I wobble along, and I'm so thankful. And don't worry, no won't always be the word you use most often. I hate that for a season, no had to be the answer to almost everything. But over time, when you rebuild a life that's the right size and dimension and weight, full of the things you're called to, emptied of the rest, then you do get to live some yes again. For a while, no is what gets you there. On disappointing people. Some people are very uncomfortable with the idea of disappointing anyone. They think that if you're kind, you'll never disappoint anyone. They think that if you try hard enough, if you manage your time well enough, if you're selfless enough, prayerful enough, godly enough, you'll never disappoint anyone. I fear these people are headed for a rude awakening. I know this because I was one of those people for so many years. I was deeply invested in people knowing that I was a very competent, capable, responsible person. I needed them to know that about me, because if that was true about me, I believed I would be safe and happy. If I was responsible and hardworking, I would be safe and happy. Fast forward to a deeply exhausted and resentful woman, disconnected from her best friends, trying so darn hard to keep being responsible, but all at once unable. Something snapped, and my anger outweighed my precious competence. Something fundamental had to change. This is what I know for sure. Along the way, you will disappoint someone. You will not meet someone's needs or expectations. You will not be able to fulfill their request. You will leave something undone or poorly done. Possibly this person will be angry with you or sad. You've left them holding the bag. Or maybe instead of sadness or anger, they'll belittle you or push all your shame buttons. Maybe they'll say things like, I guess you're just not a hard worker. Or I guess you're just a low capacity person. Or I thought I could count on you. These are basically sharp blades straight into the hearts of people like me, people who depend very heavily on meeting people's expectations. But here's the good news. You get to decide who you're going to disappoint, who you're going to say no to, and it gets easier over time, the disappointing. What you need along the way, a sense of God's deep, unconditional love, and a strong sense of your own purpose. Without those two, you'll need from people what is only God's to give, and you'll give up on your larger purpose in order to fulfill smaller purposes or other people's purposes. To be sure, finding your purpose can take a long time to figure out. And along the way, it's tempting to opt instead for the immediate gratification, the immediate fix of someone's approval. But the sweet rush of approval, the pat on the head, can often derail us from real love and real purpose. Time always helps me make these decisions. Because if I'm rushed, I always say yes. When I have time, I can instead say to myself, go back to being loved. Go back to your purpose. This thing I'm being asked to do will not get me more love, and this will not help me meet my purpose. Some of us have trouble disappointing people in authority, or people who want to impress, or people who seem fancy or important in some way. I've realized one thing that makes it hard for me to disappoint is my tendency to overestimate how close I am to someone, and then how imperative it is that I don't disappoint this dear, dear friend. But upon closer inspection, I am probably not this person's dear friend. This is probably not a deep heart wound, but probably more a small professional disappointment. Those are very different. And there's a difference between forsaking a friendship or family relationship and speaking the truth about our limitations. I'm finding that many of our friendships actually grow when we're more honest about what we can and can't do. People who don't care much about what other people think of them don't generally struggle with disappointing people. Frankly, I'm not there yet. I think this is harder for women than for men, and harder for moms than for other women, possibly because we're in that mode, that nose-wiping, cereal-pouring, need-meeting season of life. I remind myself, this will not make me feel loved, so if that's why I'm saying yes, that's not a good reason. The love I want will not be found here, and what I will feel in its place is resentment and anger. I'm committed to a particular, limited amount of things in this season, and if what's being asked of me isn't one of those, then it stands in the way. That's why knowing your purpose and priorities for a given season is so valuable, because those commitments become the litmus test for all the decisions you face. Picture your relationships like concentric circles. The inner circle is your spouse, your children, your very best friends. The next circle out is your extended family and good friends. Then the people you know, but not well, colleagues, and so on to the outer edge. Aim to disappoint the people at the center as rarely as possible. And then learn to be more and more comfortable with disappointing the people who lie at the edges of the circle. People you're not as close to. People who should not and do not require your unflagging dedication. To do this, though, you have to give even the people closest to you, maybe especially the people closest to you, realistic expectations for what you can give them. We disappoint people because we're limited. We have to accept the idea of our own limitations in order to accept the idea that we'll disappoint people. I have this much time. I have this much energy. I have this much relational capacity. And it does get easier. The first few times I had to say no were excruciating. But as you regularly tell the truth about what you can and can't do, who you are and who you're not, you'll be surprised at how some people will cheer you on, and frankly, how much less you'll care when other people don't. When you say, this is what I can do, and this is what I can't, you'll find so much freedom in that. You'll be free to love your work because you're not using it as a sneaky way to be loved or approved of. You'll be free to love the things you give to people because you're giving them freely, untangled from resentments and anger. My knee-jerk setting is yes. My default setting is yes. But I'm learning that time and honesty and space and prayer and writing and talking with Aaron help me see more clearly what I can and can't